accession number 18270, real one.
Paul Humber, real one. Where were you born, please?
My birth certificate states I was born in a nursing home in Brighton, West Sussex, on the 8th of June 1929.
Did you grow up and have your schooling in Brighton then?
No. My father farmed on a farm called Guestgate Farm in Whiston in West Sussex, and we lived on his farm along with my father's first two children, Ron and George, and my elder brother John, Peter, and myself. I'd had a sister, but sadly she died before I was born of strychnine poisoning through taking some tablets. And we lived on this farm, or we existed in a rather basic state. And I remember going to school in a little village school called Whiston, which no longer is now a school, but a junkyard. We used to walk across the fields, and on the way to the school, on the way home from school, my brother used to set rabbit wires, and on the morning we used to see if any rabbits were caught, and if there were, we used to hang them up in the trees till we came home at night time. And so we were happy, so we were more intent on rabbit catching than we were on education in those days. And it was a little school. As far as I remember, it only had one teacher, a Miss MacLeod, which is a lovely soul. And we stayed there. Unfortunately, my father came to grief on this farm, and he had to leave. And I wasn't very old at the time. I think it was about 1938. And we moved away to East Sussex. And by this time, of course, my mother had been killed in 1936. My father had remarried in 37. And by this time, there were two more children came along. And my brothers and I were the outcasts. And my elder two stepbrothers left to join the RAF. And my own elder brother, John, he left and joined the Royal Navy. And my next brother, Peter, because our three boys, we were John, Peter, and Paul. And so John had joined the Royal Navy, Peter was working on local farms, and I was an unfortunate one left with this wretched stepmother. And she dragged me along. We left East Sussex and we moved to Ropley in Hampshire in the spring of 1940, where my father had a small holding still with animals and chicken. And I was cheap labour for my stepmother. And we lived at a place called Monkwood, Longwood House Monkwood, which was about 2.5-3 miles outside of the village of Ropley itself. Rather isolated, or very isolated. And I survived there till I was 14 years of age. And the day after I left school, my stepmother called me to the door. And she said, "Here's your bits and pieces, and here's your ration book on your bike." And so I was thrown out. But I was prepared for this. And there was a local farmer about a mile away who kindly put me up with board and lodging, and I went and lived with them for about 18 months, 2 years. So, working on the farm for them. And my wage then was 25 shillings a week.
And where is Ropley?
Ropley is between Alton and Alsford, on what is known as now the Watercress Line. But during the war, we were between two railway lines, the East Meon Railway Line, which ran from Alton to Portsmouth, and the other line from Alton to Winchester, which ran, and there was a station in Ropley. And it all depended upon the weather, which way the wind was blowing, you could hear one steam train or the other, which was very interesting. So we always knew which way the wind was blowing, and because you could hear the train, the steam engine train engine chugging up through the valleys, and that was one sense of pleasure for a young miserable boy.
Did the Second World War affect you very much?
Oh yes, it curtailed. We were very poor. My father was not a very prosperous man. He was a clever engineer, but he was not a clever man with his money. And we lived a very poor life, a hard working life. Food was very scarce. And there was always airplanes and dogfights going on up in the air, guns going off at night time. You could hear the raids on Portsmouth and Southampton every night, which was quite considerable. And then when I was on this farm, I used to hear the doodlebugs go over where the certain airplanes, night fighter aircraft, would try to tip them. They'd fly beside them, and they would tip their wing to try to get them to crash out in the countryside. So we always had to be wits about us in case we had a doodlebug accidentally crashing into our houses, into our farmhouse, because the doodlebugs used to fly at quite a high speed in those days, and which was about 400 miles an hour. And these night fighter pilots were very brave men, and they would tip their wings, and they would tip them over, and then they would crash into, and quite a number crashed in and around our area. So life was hard. I couldn't do very much with 5 shillings, because I had to give a pound for lodgings and 5 shillings for myself. And we had one, I don't know if I should talk about this, but I'm afraid we used to meet on a Sunday. We had a gang used to meet on a railway bridge at Privet. And we nearly brought about a terrible disaster of our leaders. There's my friend and I and us, we went into the railway lever house, because one of the boys was his father's was a station master, and we were flipping these levers all over the place, and all of a sudden the bell rang. This was a wet Sunday afternoon, and he said, "Oh my God, there's a train on the line. Quick, get these levers back to where they should be." I wasn't touching them because I didn't know what was what, but he was throwing his levers all over the place, and he said, "Duck down quick," and the train went by. We heard a few days later that Winston Churchill and Eisenhower and Montgomery had met down the line in a big house somewhere down near Fareham to plan about the delay of D-Day. So we may have been responsible for a terrible dilemma. We pushed Winston Churchill into a siding. Yes, it was quite frightening to think about it afterwards. But there, we may have been notorious bunch of boys. So that was a rather lucky escape for all of us concerned. But that just shows you what can happen with an accident. We didn't go down there with any intentions, because normally Sundays in those days, there was nobody on the line, and so they were very quiet. But we used to hear these trains go up and down all night long, taking army equipment and tanks down to the ports.
How old would you have been when you played the prank in the signal box?
Oh, about 15 years of age, 14, 15. Yeah, 14, that was what, 1944? I'd have been 15, yes, I'd have been 15. Oh dear, come to think of it now. Perhaps I hadn't better saying about it. But there it is, it's all history now.
Anything you remember about celebrations at the end of the war?
Well, we weren't, as we lived far out into the country, we weren't subject to all this rioters gathering that one had in one's town. But so we were very isolated, and we just used to celebrate on our own, really, in a quiet. I was brought up basically solitary on my own. And when I was with my father, he never celebrated at all. Stepmother never celebrated at all. And so one wasn't used to celebrating living on. When we were in Sussex, we lived in a very isolated farmhouse. So one never met together to celebrate. So no, the answer to that is no. I don't remember celebrating.
Did you have the wireless or newspapers?
No. I never had a radio. I think my father used to listen to the radio. I think he made a radio because he was a clever engineer. But we never had a paper. No. It was life out in the country during the war was very isolated, very quiet. But I think my father had a radio and he'd listen to the news.
So did you not know what was going on in the war?
No. Well, I don't know, as a young boy, I don't know, I was that interested. All I was interested in was survival and getting the next summit, find something to eat. Going scrumping or something of that nature.
But you knew there was a war on?
Oh yeah, one was very aware of that because of all the military that was around. And when I used to go to school at Alsford, you would see all the... And we used to talk, I used to talk to the soldiers. And they used to bribe us. The American soldier, as a young man, they used to bribe us and they used to try to find out all the girls' names in and around the area and where they lived, etc., etc. And if you gave them any information, they would give you sweets or chocolates or even cigarettes if you smoked. But I didn't smoke, but they used to ply you with all these sorts of... And there was an awful... I'm afraid there was an awful black market going on in those days with petrol, food, because these American soldiers were always wanting fresh eggs and fresh meat, chicken and that. And they used to blackmail the farm. And there was a lot of black market went on with the farmers. And on this farm I go, you see American trucks turn up, or they even give you... swap their uniforms. Give their uniforms away, or parts of their underwear and equipment, which we were very much short of, because we never had any decent clothes, and clothes was rationed, food was rationed, everything was rationed, so we couldn't get anything. Petrol was rationed, so everything was in terrible short supply. So life during the war wasn't a bed of roses for a boy like me at all.
Could you catch any animals from the land?
Oh yes, I was an expert poacher. By this time, when I left school, I used to have a little 12-bore shotgun, and I used to do a bit of poaching, rabbit catching, ferreting. We used to catch rabbits and sell rabbits because we used to eat rabbits at least once a week. We're in the farm where I was in lodgings, so rabbit was very much on the menu, and it was a lovely meal. Sad that it's caught myxomatosis and has declined.
Did you ever get caught as a poacher?
No. We never saw the policeman where we lived. He would have to have cycled out on his push bike to see, which was about 3-4 miles. So the policeman wasn't too interested in coming out to our neck of the woods. You only probably saw him if there was a serious offence was committed. So no, I don't think I ever saw the policeman at Monkwood where we lived, or West Tisted. Don't remember ever seeing a policeman at all.
At West what?
West Tisted. That was a village that I moved to. After my stepmother threw me out.
Now, can you tell me how you came to be in the army, please?
Yes, by this time I was working on another farm in Ropley. And I don't know whether the farmer wanted to get rid of me or not, but they took me to Salisbury Market one day. And previous to that, I'd found my brother, long-lost brother. And by this time, he was in the parachute regiment. And I'd also lost John, my elder brother. Sadly, he was lost on HMS Royal Oak on October the 14th, 1939, aged 16 and a half, very sadly. And I had my two elder stepbrothers were in the RAF. Sadly, George... he was killed as a navigator in Iraq. He was shot down by the Iraqis, and he's buried in the Banya. And so my elder stepbrother and my brother, so we'd all had a sort of military allegiance. So when I went to Salisbury with this farmer, I made a beeline for the Army recruiting office. And there was a costume guardsman there, and he said, "Come and join the regiment, young man." I said, "All right, I will." And I was signed on there and then on the spot. And that was on it was in October 1947. So I eventually got my papers and I joined the Coast Guard Guards on October the 23rd or 24th, 1947. And I had a report to Caterham Barracks in Surrey. And so that was my first initiation into the army.
On what terms did you sign on?
5 years and 7 years. I served longer than that because I couldn't get out when my 5 years was up in October 1952. I couldn't get out at the time because of the Korean War, so I served a further 6 months.
So once you joined up, where did you do the basic training?
I did my basic training. We did our 18-week square bashing at Caterham.
What was that like?
That was very grim. Very, very, very grim. Very. I remember I had three extra parades because I went on parade one day with a couple of three dirty fingernails and I got three extra drills. And one of the extra drills on one Saturday afternoon, an Irish Guard sergeant took us for, you had an extra drill for an hour. And you lined up on the square, and I think there was about 12, 16 of us. And he said, any of you bastards here at the end of this hour, he said, I should want to know why. And so he by this time, I think I was about 8 weeks squatted, so I was pretty fit. And coming from the country, I was a fit, strong lad. But anyway, he said about tausness in this hour.
So that's about what?
Tausiness. Tausen. That means chasing you. And so we set about chasing us for this hour. And gradually, one by one, the lads was dropping out. And because it was very fast and very erratic. And we were going left, right, about turn, left turn, right turn, about turn, halt, quick march, left, right. And subject to that, constantly for an hour. It saps your energy. Anyway, at the end of this hour, there was four of us left. I thought, you swine, you're not going to get the better of me. I'm going to carry on. And there was four of us left, eight of the 16. So, but when I walked back to my barrack room, which was in Monk Block at Caterham, I just about got up the stairs and collapsed on my bed. I'd had enough. So that was a little bit of...
Why did he adopt that attitude?
I don't know. Perhaps he was just because he was an Irish Guard. The Irish Guard, and most of us, I think, were Coldstream Guards or Grenadier Guards on extra drills. And perhaps he had a bad day before, but life was very strict and very... we used to have a shining parade in the evening. And we had a trained soldier in the bed in the far end of the room. And every time we had to go in and out the room, we had to bang our tabs together and ask permission to fall in. And sometimes a trained soldier used to say, I can't hear you. Shut up. Can't hear you. Or he wouldn't answer you. So you had to stand there like an idiot until he said, come in, because you didn't dare go in the room without him saying, come in. And when you went out the room to go to the toilet or anything, you had to also stand to attention, bang your tabs in, stand to attention, and say, can I fall out, please, trained soldier? And he may not answer for a few minutes, and you may want to go to the toilet, and you left it at the last minute, you're damn near peeing yourself. So he was a torment. And at night time, we used to have a shining parade, where we all had to sit down and polish up and polish everything up. I think it was an hour and a half, I think it was. And if he didn't like it, he threw my big pack into a coal bunker one day and told me to mark time on it. God, I wept. And another time he threw my small pack out of the window in the pouring rain. So TS stood for something else, I'm afraid, as opposed to trained soldier. So, but what we discovered, that he had a girlfriend in London. And the commandant used to come round for a weekly inspection to our barrack rooms. And he used to award out, the commandant used to award prizes. And if we got a commendation, our trained soldier used to get a long weekend pass away. So that meant we were free of our trained soldier from Friday night to Sunday night. So he used to have us up about 3 or 4 o'clock in the morning, bumping the floor, polishing the floor, polishing. We used to have a chaise longue in the middle of this wretched room, and it had all thousands of brass studs all the way around. We used to have to polish these up, clean the windows, clean our bed space, make sure our bed space was all clean and tidy and adequately laid out as per rule. Our clothes inside it were neatly stacked, boots, everything all polished up, shined up. Everything had to be spit and span, and then the commandant would walk in for a few minutes and say, good men, commendation. And so that Friday night, we were free of that wretched trained soldier Bradley, I would name him. And
what did a commendation amount to?
Well, it meant high praise. And so we were free of our trained soldier Friday night and Saturday night. So we as young men, of 18-year-old young men, very highly fit, highly trained, we used to have high jinks. So it was rather rioterous. We used to have a rioterous weekend, and we used to thoroughly enjoy ourselves. But we had to calm down Sunday evening. We had to calm down and get back to normality with his wretched trained soldier was making us. Over the weekend, we used to have mock fall-ins at the door. And sometimes six or seven of us used to line up and ask one another to fall in and out. So we used to have we'd make fun of anything because we didn't have very many laughs there when trained soldier was there, but because we all had to be quiet and serious and everything else when he was there. But when he was gone, it was all bedlam, and we tried to enjoy ourselves and whatever. The least sort of thing would create a laugh, because I think we started off with about 32 in the squad, and we finished up with 16. There was 16 on the squad photograph, so, and some of those were back squadded from previous squads in front of us. So finish up with 16. What's that, half? So that will show you how tough joining the Coast Guard Guards was.
Did this period at Caterham do you any good?
Did it do me any good? That's very debatable, I suppose. It did me a good in one way, I suppose. I don't know why they had to be so petty. Lots of rules and regulations had to be so petty. Because directly we left there, we went to Wellington Barracks, where we were free of all these restrictions. We still had to be strict disciplining on soldiers, of course. I totally agree with that. But I think there was a lot of pettiness that crept in. Because I remember a weapons training instructor we had, if he did anything that he didn't agree with, and we used to train with a weapon training, we used to train with a tin helmet on. And this particular weapons training instructor, Purcell, he used to get hold of your chin strap, your elastic strap under your tin helmet, and he would pull it down and he'd let it go. And that used to boil my blood. Oh, dear, it did it. And sometimes you'd do it two or three times. So that sort of thing was very niggling, and it wasn't necessary. But this was 1947, and it was one of the worst winters on record, I believe, and Caterham Barracks was cold, freezing cold, and it was the coldest winter on record, I think, or one of the coldest. So life at Caterham was, but looking back on it now, we survived, or some of us survived. And
what happened at Wellington Barracks?
Well, we were supposed to have gone to Purbeck to do our weapons training for and assault courses, but unfortunately, with the rapid demobilisation of other Coast Guard Guardsmen who wanted to leave the regiment at the end of the war, they were short of soldiers to do public duties. So we went straight from a raw recruit at Caterham. We were then thrown in the deep end, and we went on public duties at Buckingham Palace, St James's Palace, Tower of London, bank picket, and all those sorts of things. So we went straight under those duties at Wellington Barracks.
Where is Wellington Barracks?
Wellington Barracks is a stone's throw from Buckingham Palace, along Birdcage Walk, which runs down to Big Ben from Buckingham Palace Road down to Birdcage Walk. I think it was called Birdcage Walk because I think it was George II used to have a bird aviary down in Green Park, which is the other side of the road from Wellington Barracks.
What were conditions like in Wellington Barracks?
Very austere. I think the first week we're there, we heard a rifle go off, and suddenly blood appeared in the sea, and unfortunately one of our colleagues upstairs shot himself. So life was very austere, but we were free of our trained soldier, our beloved trained soldier. So life was quite relaxed there.
Why do you think he shot himself?
I don't know. I think we all felt like it at times. I think if life got you down, but you had to make sure that life didn't get you down, and you had to try and laugh at anything and everything and try to enjoy yourself. And we could go out at night time, provided we were properly dressed. Otherwise, we couldn't get out of the gate. And they used to send you back for fiddly little things again. So that the sergeant, the guard there was another annoyance. And today, I think they walk out with long hair and God knows what else, I think. But life in those days, 50 years ago, life in those days was very austere. And
in what way austere?
Well, as I say, we didn't have... I think my salary on joining the army was also 25 shillings a week when I first joined at Caterham. And I think 10 shillings was held back for barrack room damages in case we beat the barrack room up or something. And so they held a certain amount of our pay back, and we could only draw that out when we went on leave. But life as a young, suddenly leaving home, no, I didn't have a decent home, but so it didn't affect me like a lot of the other lads. But some of the lads used to sit down and cry every night time, think, oh, dear mother, dear sister. But I'm afraid I hadn't shared that type of life, so it didn't affect me. But I sympathised with them. But life was quite, say, we only had 25, 30 shillings a week, and very demanding life because we were constantly on duty. We used to do public duties on duty for four on, two on, four off when we were on public duties. And being woken up at 2 o'clock in the morning to go on duty, or 1:30 to go on duty at 2 o'clock or 4 o'clock, it was not my idea of a cup of tea.
Can you describe what the public duties involved?
Yes, if you're on Buckingham Palace duty, it all depended if the Queen was in residence or wasn't in. Because when I was there, the King was, King George VI was alive. When we first went in 1948, there were 8 sentries on the front gate of Buckingham Palace, and we used to do 2 on, 4 off. That was 2 hours on duty and 4 hours off duty. So, and then if he wasn't in residence, I think it was 8 hours off. So we always hoped he wasn't in residence, so we had a longer break. Of course, if you're on duty, in those days, we were on duty outside the palace, where the general public would poke fun at you.